This joint meeting of the House and Senate Health and Social Services Committees will now come to order. It is 3:32 p.m. Thursday, February 12, 2026 in Davis 106. Members present are Senators Myers, Klayman, Geisel, Dunbar, and Representatives Ruffridge, Mears, Gray, Prox, and myself, and Representative Fields has also just joined us. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Andrew Giannotti as Health and Social Services Recording Secretary and Zach Lawhorn, our LIO moderator. Katie Jojo is my committee aide, and if you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get her attention. Today, we have a presentation about the Alaska Rural Health Transformation Program. We've had many presentations about this program from the Department of Health, and we wanted to take this opportunity to really talk about the possibilities that can be done with funding from RHTP. Today, we have Monique Martin from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Nancy Merriman with the Alaska Primary Care Association, and Jared Kosin with the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association to talk about the RHTP. These organizations were part of the application and development of the RHTP, and we are looking forward to hearing of their work with the RHTP and how this will impact Alaska. So to our presenters, please come to the presenter's table, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you so much to Chairs Dunbar and Mina for scheduling this meeting to help share information on the Rural Health Transformation Program. For the record, my name is Monique Martin. I serve as the Vice President of Intergovernmental Affairs for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jared Kosin. I am President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association and appreciate the opportunity to be here.
And thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Merriman, and I am the CEO of the Alaska Primary Care Association.
For the record, this is Monique Martin. I'm going to kick us off with a little bit of sort of level setting about the Rural Health Transformation Program. If we could go back one slide for a minute, please. As Chair Mina mentioned, our organizations serve as part of the Advisory Council to the Department of Health and Commissioner Hedberg and her team to help provide informed, structured, and practical input so that the Rural Health Transformation Program, the efforts, the projects are implemented effectively and sustainably. A big component of the Notice of Funding Opportunity that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services released is sustainability in the future. And as we have watched various hearings before legislative committees, we are acutely tuned into conversations that legislators have raised, really wanting to understand implications of the Rural Health Transformation Program, RHTP, and understanding clearly how we build a program that doesn't leave future legislators holding the bag and trying to fill that bag. So that is something we spend a lot of time talking about as part of the Advisory Council, but also when we talk to various groups that we represent, and really anyone who will listen, is really thinking about how do we build these programs sustainably for the future. I think one of the things, when I previously worked at the Department of then Health and Social Services, we were in development of the 1115 Behavioral Health Waiver. And my colleague, formerly at the state that I now work with at ANTHC, largely led that effort. And through that process, we heard Medicaid is an incredibly important tool for expanding access to behavioral health services for Alaskans. However, we heard time and time again, there's places that Medicaid just doesn't fill the gap. How do we build the facility? How do we train the workforce? How do we get workforce into our rural communities? So we see this might be that opportunity to kind of help fill that gap and look at additional opportunities we have in the future. We'll talk a little bit about the program context, a little bit of how we're really going to evaluate this opportunity from a perspective of provider organizations, and really what we're helping to people understand about this opportunity. And really, we have a lot of questions, as do you, about what this program really is, what it's meant to do, and how can we really maximize this opportunity while caring for some of the requirements that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has outlined. So a little bit about the program level setting for folks watching at home is the RHTP program was authorized through the budget reconciliation process known as HR1, One Big Beautiful Bill, whatever you might want to call it. I like to provide a little bit of context because some of us know it is a different thing. So that level setting is really important with this opportunity because there are a lot of questions. This program allocates $50 billion to rural health transformation over the next 5 years. And we've seen in this program some definitions regarding the distribution of money, which actually helps level set states competing against one another. Oftentimes, we see grants distributed based on population size, and we don't often fare well in our state when we compete like that, but half of the money was distributed equally among states. Alaska was awarded $272 million in year one. This is the second highest allocation of any state. There was some media coverage about Alaska's award amount. It got a lot of attention and continues to get a lot of attention. And this really equates to Texas was the state with the largest appropriation for the Rural Health Transformation Program, equates to about $9 for every Texas resident. In our state, that's just shy of $370 per resident in our state. So we have a incredibly high, as we should, right? There's no place that's rural quite like Alaska rural. So this is an incredible opportunity for us. And I think one of the things we've spent a lot of time talking about and really asking for clarity from CMS is there's calling out in the notice of funding opportunity that monies could be clawed back if a state fails to meet their deliverables. And I always direct people, think about the milestones that I believe begin on page 40 in the state's application as a little bit of how CMS might grade the Department of Health and Alaskan organizations that ultimately apply for and receive an award. How are we achieving the vision that's outlined in the application for the Rural Health Transformation Program?
Senator Giesel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question, Ms. Martin. The questions that I'm getting from people, first of all, is what is rural? And the second question is, are we going to make sure this actually gets to the far reaches of our state? Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. For purposes of, let's go to the technical part of the Rural Health Transformation Program, the entire state of Alaska qualifies as rural. But as part of the state's application, they had to define rural, and they list several measures in the Department of Health's application of how we're defining rural. And really, they say everywhere except for the municipality of Anchorage is considered rural. However, they do go on to clarify that because of the unique nature of healthcare in our state, a small population over a large geography, services provided in Anchorage will be, and service providers, organizations, social service agencies that are in Anchorage are eligible. So the entirety of our state is eligible to apply for Rural Health Transformation Program dollars. And to your point about, how do we make sure these dollars get to the rural, the most rural communities, from the tribal health perspective, and really from my partners here at the table today, we've talked about that a lot, because these opportunities are once in a lifetime, probably once in a generation, really, to expand services to Alaskans. And if we are not very thoughtful in the process that we develop and the hurdles people have to go over in terms of reporting, developing applications, we will drive further health disparities for Alaskans living in rural communities. It is a big part of our conversation regularly with the Department of Health. And I think we've really seen that acknowledged in the four pathways to funding that the Department of Health has outlined, where some groups have said, some of our smallest community health centers, smallest social service agencies have said, we just don't apply for grants like this. We are simply too small. So we don't even know where to start. And so that administrative readiness component is really acknowledging some of the smallest organizations in our most rural communities. How do we help them get ready to move towards that planning phase? So I think we've really seen the Department of Health set up a very thoughtful process to help Alaskan organizations see themselves in a pathway to funding. And I think that's really important.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. At the same time, there are these new grants. Providers are also navigating sort of an intentional maze of red tape designed to cut off care. Talk about some of the barriers that you all are going to navigate in terms of work requirements, verifying that people are, in fact, Alaska Natives or other categories that are supposed to be exempt from the new Medicaid restrictions, and how challenging is it going to be to navigate all those before you try to hopefully also grab some new money? Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jared Cosin. Through the chair, Representative Fields, I think we just have a few more slides.
Oh, okay.
And we're going to talk about the challenge of the timing of this issue before us, and I think it would be a good way to kind of dovetail on some of the questions you have. So I'd ask, and deferentially, of course, if we could just cover those slides and then get back.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Monique Martin again. On this slide, we outline the six initiatives. These are really the big buckets that the state has outlined in the Rural Health Transformation Program application in terms of where they're seeing projects. And I've been clear to share with folks, just because you don't see your particular program or service line identified in the application, really look at the overarching themes that are in these initiatives and show how your project might tie to some of the initiatives. Because we know things that maybe work in the YK Delta region might be different than what they need in the Bristol Bay area or in the interior. So we really want folks to not feel too hemmed in by what they see in those initiatives, really find a place for what they think would drive outcomes for Alaskans in their communities. And I should say, I shamelessly used some of the Department of Health slides from their January convening at the Hilton. And I really encourage Alaskans who are interested more to go to the Alaska Department of Health website. They have right at the top of their page a link to the Rural Health Transformation Program, and it is a wealth of knowledge. So I'll try and call some of these out. I included a link at the bottom. For those watching at home, they can go right to that link and see some of these presentations. But these are directly slides that the Department of Health presented to help really make sure Alaskans were aware of this opportunity. They had some space limitations because we are moving fast and furious to get information out there. So challenging to find a place big enough to hold the convening. But on this slide, I think you see the three big goals that the Department of Health has outlined as part of their application. And then where do each of those six initiatives on the previous slide fit in to the state's program? You know, we've talked to a lot of people who say, well, I'm not a healthcare provider, so I probably don't qualify for these monies. And that's simply not the case. And this is another slide. The Department of Health talks about this a lot in terms of who might be eligible. And even if you don't see yourself listed in the color chart on the left side of the screen, you are still eligible, right? The Department of Health is going to list information about what are requirements, but if you're a social service agency providing childcare in a rural community, you qualify. So Commissioner Hedberg has talked a lot about childcare as an important part of supporting our workforce to make sure that the lack of childcare in their community does not preclude them from work opportunities in their regions.
I have a quick question. I'm curious, as you've all been very involved in this stakeholder engagement process, what are some examples of entities and organizations that don't traditionally interact with the Department of Health or these types of grants that should be engaged in the RHTP?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think some of the groups I think about are a lot of social service agencies that are maybe helping people with expanding or upskill opportunities where they think about workforce being very different than the healthcare delivery system. Schools, community centers that maybe have the opportunity with a little extra assistance, planning, et cetera, that could keep their doors open longer, maybe dedicate some time for seniors to come in the morning or afternoon when they typically have quieter hours. And how do we take advantage of facilities that are already in existence in our rural communities, like schools or other facilities, where we could say, hey, let's open this up for seniors. Let's open this up for whoever might be really lacking in access to, in the long winter months, some of that physical activity that would help. The department has talked about how we really want to focus on more access to preventative care, less acute care access. How do we make sure that Alaskans get connected to those preventative services? Things like getting out and be able to walk more, go swimming, whatever it might be. I think there's a great opportunity for folks that train people in CPR or first aid that maybe just don't typically see themselves in a state grant process.
Through the chair, I would also add, for me, that comes to mind, childcare, even though, of course, childcare intersects with the department, but not in this way, where you're going for transformation in a way in which can support the larger healthcare system. And EMS, again, same thing. Obviously, EMS interacts with the Department of Health, but there's some really innovative models for delivering care at a lower level setting that could be explored. So those are two other organizations that I think come to mind.
Thank you. And we have a question from Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked about healthcare a couple of times, and early on you talked about sustainability. And so in a very, very rough economic sense, if we said we're going to put $3 million a year for the next 5 years towards child care, I am 100% sure there would be child care providers across the state that would be more than happy to take some of that money, and we could figure out a way to get it to them. And then 5 years from now, suddenly the three $3 million a year is gone. Specifically in childcare, how do we align this effort of the transformation and make that sustainable?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, one of the things that we've talked about specific to childcare in that is helping people get the right training that they might need, or even building out facilities. While there is a strict limitation on buying or building new facilities, renovations are allowable to an extent. The Department of Health is pushing hard on their partners at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for what's the line, right? Like, how far do renovations, how far can they go? But we know that's one of the biggest things. Are there opportunities to look at existing space to renovate, that we would be able to repurpose existing buildings or expand existing service lines by maybe adding on to a facility? So I think the extent of which renovations will be allowed is a little bit of an unknown through guidance from CMS. And we are always looking for that. But I think there's the opportunity to really look at facilities maybe in our communities that we could repurpose, revamp, maybe make some of the improvements to protect child safety.
Thank you. Please proceed.
For the record, this is Jared Cosin. I'm going to start my part of the presentation, if you will. And as Monique just did a really nice job giving context on kind of how we got here, the next thing we're going to talk about is really evaluating the opportunity. And not so much from a department standpoint, not so much from a government standpoint, but really from an outside provider perspective as we can offer it. And when I say evaluating the opportunity, really the first thing that comes to mind to us are the challenges. And I think it's important to be realistic. I mean, Senator Klayman just asked a really good question about childcare, and you can try and answer that 10 different ways, but the point is, that's a good question, and I don't think we know. And I think that kind of plays into this idea of we have this massive opportunity in front of us in terms of dollars, but it's full of challenges that we have to all be realistic about. And so for looking at that, I guess what we would want to highlight is, you know, we have $272 million coming to the state for this first year. And a lot of people will call this 5 years of funding. And we like to look at it more of as cycles or tranches of funding. Because, well, yes, you're going to get funding each year for over a period of 5 years. There's a two-year spend window for recipients of those funds. And so we have to look at it kind of a little bigger and more of this kind of tranche idea. And so the framework, the way this is supposed to work as we understand it from CMS is money comes, the award is determined, states have 1 year to obligate those funds, and then whoever gets the funds essentially has 2 years to exhaust them, to expend them in full. And so I'm going to rewind back to where we are today, but I'm going to spend 1 minute just kind of looking forward to give an idea of how chaotic this can get from a timeline standpoint. So if we want to look at a typical tranche timeline and how they intersect, let's just pretend we wake up tomorrow and it's going to be October 1st of this year. That means federal fiscal year 2027 begins. Here is what we would expect. If we woke up and say it was October 1st, we would know the state at that point, all awards have been issued, right? That 1 year spending obligation by the state will have passed. They better have gotten all the money out. We also would know at that point that we've hit a deadline that if you have received funds, you have 1 year left to spend it. At that very same day, at that very same time, we would also be tuning in to obviously the internet, because there would be an announcement coming from CMS on how much we're going to get for the next tranche of money. And on that very same day, we would expect the Department of Health would be rolling out their awards process for actually awarding out tranche two of funds. So all of this stuff intersects. There's a lot of money coming in. There's a lot of money that has to be allocated. And it all happens in a pretty short window. And so if we look forward, I guess the big takeaway for us, and we have all been, from a provider standpoint, cognizant of this well before the award came in. And so now we're back to today. The clock has been ticking. The funds that we were talking about today, the first $272 million, we heard about that December 31st. We all know that, right? A lot of people don't know, and I know you do. This is more for the record and for the public. The clock on spending this money started on October 1st. And so that means as of this hearing today, based on what we just talked about, the framework, the $272 million that tranche one, the state has to obligate all those funds within the next 7.5 months. That means, stated differently, we have 7.5 months to stand up our grant system, to formally solicit everybody in the state for proposals, 7.5 months to receive that solicitation, develop a thorough application, and submit it. Within that 7.5 months, scoring of that application, award decisions, and then distribution. All of that just in the 7.5 window, in my opinion, that's a lot. That's a lot of work to accomplish. The concerning part of that, just to be totally candid, is the spend window also started on October 1st. So that means even with all this stuff that has to happen in the next 7.5 months, from today, we have 19 months as providers, if we do or do not, you know, get funding for this, you're going to have 19 months from today to spend that money. None of us have that money yet to spend. In fact, we are building the system as we speak. And so for me and us, I would say, the takeaway here is you as the legislature know well there's so much that still has to happen. So many questions that Nancy Merriman will go into that we just don't know about. And we have time pressure on top of that. And the time pressure doesn't mean we need to rush and panic and do all this just to get the money out and spend it. But I think it does mean we have to be very careful with delays. It's hard to spend a lot of money, even on individual projects, in 19 months for providers. And so that's a very, very real concern.
I say it's hard to spend it smartly.
Smartly.
We could waste $270 million.
You believe it. Through the chair. Very good point. But also even getting that money out the door to actually physically expend it on projects when you can't use it on construction to the fullest extent.
Right.
You know, we have a feeling it might even be hard to actually physically spend those dollars in that small window. But point taken for sure.
And we have a question from Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with this timeline, you know, one thing that pops up to my mind is, you know, rural most of the time means small organizations, small staffs. And we're talking about, you know, I know that Department of Health is still putting together a lot of the requirements and what the applications need to look like and stuff. But what are your organizations able to do for some of the smaller providers in helping them craft some of those applications so that they have plans ready and eligible for some of this money?
Through the chair, Senator, thanks for that question, and certainly you guys chime in as well. In answering your question, I do want to be very clear for the record. None of this is the Department of Health's fault, and I think we all know that. This is CMS's fault. Designing this in the way in which it was designed was very poorly done because of the amount of time they did it and what the expectations are. Regardless of how you feel about all of it, it was a poor approach to doing this. With that said, it's a big opportunity and we need to seize it. And so I can speak for my organization, and I know there's other organizations out there doing things like this, but we recognize what you just said, is we realize, well, wait a minute, we have a couple small hospitals in particular who don't have grant writers on staff. They know how to administer programs. They have the ability to administer programs, but they don't have people to actually write grants. And so that was a wake-up call for us. It was something we didn't even consider. Someone brought this up about 2.5 weeks ago to us, and we said, wait, that's not good. And so we immediately went to our internal resources, and we made a call out to our facilities and are going to pair our smaller facilities that need that help with grant writers for the first round of funding so they have a fair, equitable shot. But we're also lucky to be in that position. You know, I can't say everyone else is in the same position, but I'll open it up to my colleagues here.
Through the chair, Senator Myers. For the record, Nancy Merriman, Alaska Primary Care Association. There are certainly small health centers in our most frontier and rural locations across the state that are challenged with the thought of applying for this money, which has so many rules and compliance factors to it. I think it's been really good and heartening to see that the department has created a planning and a readiness pathway for these organizations. So if they have a good idea for something that they want to do in their community, but really need to build their administrative muscle to get there, there is a pathway for them to apply for that time and for those resources to build that up.
Madam Chair, if I may, for the record, this is Monique Martin. Through the chair, Senator Myers, one of the things we're doing at ANTHC is, one, talking about the Rural Health Transformation Program so folks are really aware. And that oftentimes means people have a lot more questions than we have answers. But I think one of the things that we've spent a lot of time doing is, especially in year one, specifically because of that time frame that Jared just outlined, is I think some folks have heard transformation and think, oh, it's got to be something brand new that I haven't thought of yet. And that's simply not the case. If organizations have a strategic plan, that they've already gone through a planning process with their boards of directors or leadership teams or community members, look to those existing things they already have. What are things people can do quickly in year one? One of the things we're thinking about is equipment, and thinking about that in terms of financial sustainability might look different in a state like ours. That, and I don't have a great example of this, but I will work on one, is, you know, if folks are limited to services in Anchorage, are there services that we could provide closer to home and hub communities that would maybe still cost us the same amount of money, but we're taking off that travel component, right? That oftentimes is the barrier between Alaskans getting healthcare. We just spent a lot of time yesterday back in Anchorage talking about Alaskans, and just in the news last night, colorectal cancer screening rates. It is really challenging to get people to want to get a colorectal cancer screening. And then also, by the way, hop on a plane, come into Anchorage or your neighborhood hub community, and do the prep, do all the things. And are there is there opportunities for us to make sure the providers are going to the hub communities more? We already do that. But is there an opportunity with equipment that we could, that makes sense in terms of numbers of screenings provided, mammograms, you name it? Are there things that we could be doing closer to home that help us reduce the cost of transportation, which as that rises, we're seeing more and more spent on transportation, and it's really squeezing healthcare. So there's that opportunity where we can look at maybe equipment as an opportunity for us.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I guess, are you developing some sort of a plan, probably on a chalkboard rather than chiseled in stone, but are you kind of, because it does seem difficult to get an organized plan statewide that big with these constraints, but are you working on a publishing a plan or something like that?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Prox. Our organizations, the answer, I guess, short answer is no. I don't think in the way you're envisioning it. We have helped advise the department when they've asked us questions, you know, with our respective organizations. I know we all overlap in healthcare, so we're constantly talking about ideas. We all probably would do it differently, depending on which one of us you would talk to. Right. So I think what we're looking to is to see what the department is thinking and really looking at the solicitation process. I think when that gets opened up, we're going to see a lot of projects out there, and that the people that can do the projects, I think, are going to be the ones that will be driving the ideas that could lead to meaningful transformation. And so, no, I don't think we're all putting it on a chalkboard. I think we have ideas on what the chalkboard would look like, but our organizations together are not creating the plan for with the department. I think we're more advising them along the way, if that makes sense.
Follow up?
Let me rephrase that a little bit then. Through the chair, have 5, 6, 7 years ago, you were thinking about, gee, I wonder if we could do this. Do you have that list?
Through the chair, so within our organizations, and we're obviously different, for the record, this is Jared Kosin from the Hospital and Healthcare Association. I mean, I know my members, which are all of Alaska's hospitals, nursing homes, and we have behavioral health providers and a growing number of other provider types, all of them have their strategic plans. All of them have what they want to do and could do. And I think the question is, what aligns with the vision behind this sum of money? What is practical? What can you actually spend in 24 months or 19 months or whatever it is, which is not that easy?
Yep.
So, yes, I think those ideas all exist out there. I think it's going to be coalescing and making it fit within this process. That's going to be the big challenge. Mm-hmm. But the ideas are there.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, through the chair, Representative Prox, at ANTHC, we've gone through that strategic planning document that was developed by the ANTHC Board of Directors as a starting point. Mm-hmm. I should say our our operational team looking at this as an opportunity, right? And also, though, we realize that this is intended to be transformational. So we released a survey at ANTHC, sent to every single employee at the organization, and said, what are one of those things or some of those things that you think we could implement as an organization that maybe we've just never been able to do or even had the time to think about that could really move the dial for healthcare outcomes? And we had an incredible response to those, and really great ideas. One of those was lactation specialists. We have lactation specialists to help new moms, but we don't have 24/7 coverage for those. And babies are born at all times of day and night, maybe just not conveniently Monday through Friday between 8 and 5 p.m. So we're looking to expand those services even more, maybe help new moms. We have a pretty robust patient housing system. Oftentimes, new moms are discharged from the hospital, but they're not quite ready to go home yet. So can we go and meet them at the patient lodging facilities that we operate to ensure they're getting the supports they need, really in acknowledgement of the state's Healthy Beginnings Initiative and this application? So those are some of the one of the ideas that came through from our survey of employees. And there's some really great ideas to help Alaskans that need services, right? Like, as a provider, we're seeing things like equipment and all these exciting, shiny things. And there's a lot of things that are just really more nuanced and maybe people-based that would really move the dial on healthcare outcomes.
Thank you. Please continue.
Great. For the record, I'm Nancy Merriman, Alaska Primary Care Association. So good afternoon, Chair Dunbar and Chair Mina and members of your committees. I am the CEO of the Alaska Primary Care Association, where my team and I work to support the Alaska's 29 federally qualified health center organizations. And they operate over 200 clinic sites across Alaska, and collectively they provide comprehensive primary care services to 1 in 6 Alaskans. Commissioner Hedberg asked APCA to serve on the advisory council along with ANTHC and the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association last August, and we've really appreciated the opportunity to engage and support the initial planning and to provide input to the department as they build the framework for Alaska's Rural Health Transformation Program proposal to CMS. As noted by my colleagues, Ms. Martin and Mr. Cosin, the segment of our testimony that I am going to present is intended to help underscore the many important questions that still remain at this stage. Even as state leaders and stakeholders continue to explore opportunities for collaboration and while prospective applicants prepare their letters of interest, I'm going to highlight questions in a few categories. The first one is construction. We know many organizations in Alaska wish to secure resources to support new construction projects and building expansions. And we have learned from the department and CMS grant guidance that new construction costs are not permitted. But questions remain about what exactly is permissible related to renovation, expansion, and other similar projects. Applicants are going to need answers to questions about whether specific costs are eligible and to whom to direct those questions. There's a level of uncertainty about who has the authority to approve or deny projects and what that approval process will look like and how long it will take. Once answers to construction-related questions are obtained, then how will these be shared and other prospective applicants learn about those experiences and additional lessons learned in the first budget period funding cycle? So next, I'm just going to highlight a few questions about the understandable restriction on supplanting existing federal funds. With recognition of that restriction, will the state of Alaska be required to secure CMS approval for specific waivers to support innovative payment and care delivery models that are articulated in the state's Rural Health Transformation Program proposed plans? And what other approvals are needed in order to move forward with innovative voluntary value-based care or value-based payment projects? And then how are authorized payers defined? There's also some questions about broadband and connectivity. Throughout Alaska, of course, we continue to work on strengthening broadband infrastructure, something critical for healthcare transformation. And we've been challenged with resolving broadband infrastructure in affordable and sustainable ways. How will we deliver on implementing new promising technology and transformation in the short timeline of this program when we struggle to meet basic telecommunication infrastructure and equipment needs in our rural regions? You also might be wondering about multi-year projects. We know many of the folks that we're talking to are wondering about those. And many folks are thinking about transformative projects that are going to be multi-year and multi-budget period. So they're seeking answers about how to describe, plan, and apply for funding for those multi-period projects. So how will those long-term plans be considered, and how will the awards be determined beyond the initial two-year time span? Will preference be given to those projects? How can they plan for long-term projects if they don't have some certainty in future funding? But on the other side, if there are multi-period projects that are considered, would they edge out new innovative projects that just get proposed in budget period three, for example? The state of Alaska has said that indirect costs are not permissible for rural health transformation project grantees. Organizations are wondering how they'll cover the real costs of managing and implementing those projects. Are indirect and administrative cost limitations tracked on a per-project basis, or is that indirect costs are disallowed altogether in totality? How will organizations learn more about those restrictions so that their project plans are well-informed, and ultimately they can determine whether a project is feasible or not? So you can see that things are moving fast, and this is a massive program. The department is in routine, regular, frequent conversation with CMS. And we know that they are, like, even as we speak, getting more information and more answers. And not only is CMS, like, really trying to figure out the answers, sometimes they're figuring out what the questions are. So I would say, despite the numerous questions that remain, the $272 million investment in the Alaska healthcare system each year for the next 5 years is vital for our state and worth the effort to invest in it. So I'll yield the mic at this point.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this question doesn't directly tie to this slide, but I was wondering about your role as the advisory council. Your three entities, and I believe it's the fourth, the medical association, or there's a fourth entity, isn't there, or is it just the three
trust.
Of you? The trust. Thank you. The Mental Health Trust is the fourth entity. So I know that you have been very involved the last several months and early on. What is your role going forward? And you mentioned, you know, selecting these projects, approving these projects. The way it seems to be structured now is that the commissioner has kind of an up-down decision, and $200 million or more sort of vested in this one person without legislative input, by the way, as the law currently stands. Is that your understanding? And regardless, what do you see as your own role going forward? And maybe more importantly, how does DOH see your role going forward?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I think this is sort of like a lot of things around the Rural Health Transformation Program, kind of ever evolving. And as we've talked with Commissioner Hedberg, I think there will be a very robust evaluation of applications. It's not just going to be the commissioner with her highlighter saying yay or nay on applications. And they were really working with the Alaska Community Foundation to develop a very thoughtful, data-driven process that is as supportive for applicants as it need be. And so I think that while the commissioner is sort of listed as the final say on this, I think there will be a very robust process for folks to be able to look at and say, was this developed in a vacuum or was it really developed based on data on the best projects rose to the top? And I think the Department of Health is probably better suited to maybe get into some of the mechanics with the Alaska Community Foundation, who will be serving as the sub-grant administrator, sort of as the recipient of the letters of interest that were talked about Tuesday at a webinar, and then really helping applicants through that process. So I think there's a pretty robust process in mind by the Department of Health. And as far as our role, I think Commissioner Hedberg has said it best, where we might be more of a directional support versus decision-making. So you won't see us voting yay or nay or ranking projects or anything like that. We are really to be a voice for, especially in future years. We've outlined, the department outlined a vision for the Rural Health Transformation Program in their application. And as we see year one awards, where do we maybe need to be a little bit more targeted in years two or three? Did we see lots of equipment and now let's get to workforce or technology? Really seeing what rose to the top in year one as meeting the goals and initiatives, but also doable in year one. And then maybe we would provide some insight on, hey, we need a little bit more focus on workforce. We need to see more focus in childcare or education or certification. So it would really be more of that, I think, the highest level, and I think the commissioner said it best, is directional versus decision-making.
Well, first, if either of you have somebody to add to that, and then I've got a follow-up.
I'll hold for your follow-up. Go ahead.
Good. I'll just, you know, this is a large enough sum of money that it's not just the people on this panel that are concerned about it. And so I've spoken with a number of my colleagues, and they point towards examples of the CARES Act or even our own Department of Transportation in some years, where there is this supposed rubric of how things are scored, and then right at the last minute, it goes into the governor's office or somewhere like that, and then all of a sudden there's new projects on there that weren't even scored or were scored quite differently, and now they've been awarded this. And so I guess my question to you, or it's not even a question because ultimately it's the Department of Health, is, you know, what can you do to promote a transparency in the rubric or the criteria how these are selected, and then sort of hold the line that if a project actually does meet the criteria, it is actually the one that is awarded, versus, again, at sort of towards the end of the process, there is a resorting in an opaque fashion. Any comments on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll start. And you used the word that I would have answered before with transparency. And I think that's the most important thing. You know, our role, as Monique so well put, everything's been evolving. I mean, honestly, our involvement really came out of the fact that we've just been looking ahead. When it was talked about that this money would be coming, all of us collectively just started talking about what's it going to take to actually do this? And can the department do that? Will they have the resources? Because we want to make sure things are done as least disruptive as possible for the healthcare system. And going back to Representative Fields, I certainly haven't forgotten your question from earlier, but we're already looking ahead to, you know, what's coming down the pike with Medicaid. In preparing for this presentation today, we spent most of our day actually talking about Medicaid and eligibility and what that's all going to mean in the coming months with this very large challenge in front of us today. So I guess this is all to say that I think our hope, and we have gone back and forth on this as a group, is really the legislature needs to be involved to ensure that transparency exists. And I think the Department of Health would agree to that. I look at each of you, Vice Chair Giesel, you know, with your healthcare experience and everyone else, you guys have a wealth of experience among yourselves, and you guys will ask questions that we want to ask and questions that are even above what we would ask. And I think we all have to be transparent through this process. And so that's my hope. And I would also balance it with, don't forget about time. If we delay too much, and I'm not saying willful delay, we're just going to put providers, not even the three of us, but actual providers, they're going to be limited to actually putting this money to use. So how do you balance that? And I think it all comes back to transparency and not having situations like you just described happen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I saw Representative Ruffridge and then Gray and then Senator Klayman and then Mears.
Thank you, Chair Mina. Well, thanks for being here today. This is a really amazing opportunity, and I have to first thank the Department of Health for the work that they're putting. I know they're night and day, it feels like, on this work. I'd like to maybe steer just a little off the RHTP for just a second and utilize your three's expertise in the healthcare space. You each come from a very different perspective, and I think as advisory council members probably have given this advice maybe in the meetings that you're in. What specifically, kind of from each of you, do you think in your sort of perspective spaces are the biggest needs that RHTP could fill? I'm still struggling to wrap my head around. Like, on a grand scale, I know big needs, but I don't think the RHTP money can be used for that because of all of the limitations. Do you just have some general thoughts on if it were up to you today and you could kind of say, each of you get a cool, you know, $90 million to spend for each of your groups, what would you do?
Do you want to go first? Or?
Through the chair, Nancy Merriman, for the record, the 29 federally qualified health centers across the state have a myriad of ideas about things that they'd like to see to improve their own clinics and their communities. And so the ideas range from standing up a geriatric clinic or a wound care clinic within their FQHC, to helping the school establish a school-based clinic or help the community stand up additional supports and programming for the community's youth. So I think those programs are smaller maybe than a brand new building, but they can in totality be transformational for a community.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I'm, you know, reminded of even conversations we had earlier today of just kind of bold ideas that would be worth considering. But, you know, for me, there's two things that come to mind right away. The first is, even though I represent hospitals and nursing homes and these larger providers, we are big believers in community-based services, with the idea that it's far more affordable to have people getting access in the community, far more efficient. There's so many positive aspects to that. So, you know, in an ideal world, I would like to see service line development specifically for behavioral health and other services. My problem is the way this appears to be structured by CMS is it doesn't seem like it really will do that. And this goes back to kind of the question from Representative Klayman. If I had an opportunity to design this for a day at the federal level, I would have said, for Alaska at least, I would have absolutely allowed all construction. And the reason I would have done that is because, to me, if you can front load upfront costs to whether it's building, bringing providers on, bringing equipment in, all that stuff is one-time expenses. if you could pay for that with this funds, then what's left is you're left with basically an operation that you can turn on. And once you turn it on, you start seeing patients and you get revenue. So it's self-sustaining. So to me, the fact that this money can't fully potentially be used for that one-time upfront cost kind of disadvantages some of the things that I would like to see strategically happen, just to be candid. And that leads me to kind of my final answer. And I've expressed this, and we've expressed this with the department transparently. I would run an open solicitation process. I would want to see what the ideas are out there in the field and then respond to those ideas and build around them on what I think is good, rather than lay out the ideas I want to see happen, if that makes sense.
Madam Chair, if I may, because the dream big one is something that's really exciting. Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I'm going to steal an idea from Dan Nelson at Tanana Chiefs Conference. Tanana Chiefs Conference provides care in a region that would be in the top five biggest states in the country if it were a state. And it was sort of funny. During the convening in January, there was talk about drones to deliver medications, right? Like controlled substances, right? Like we'll talk about and that type of thing. And there were some out-of-state vendors that sort of chuckled at like, oh, delivering medications via drone. That's so silly. And I'm like, actually, I couldn't help myself, told them that there are at least two tribal health organizations that would like to stand up drone delivery, because the only way they get medications to those communities is via river. So during freeze up and break up, they don't get deliveries to those communities. So they see drones as a possibility to make sure that patients don't go without medications when they need it. I think that there's also just... When I think of opportunities, you know, less exciting than drones dropping off packages at front doors is we have an electronic health record. We have a shared Cerner domain in the tribal health system that a big number of the tribal health organizations and tribes utilize. Not everyone, but we know it could be better, and that a better electronic health record, an EHR, would mean better health outcomes when a patient is maybe getting care at a tribal and a non-tribal facility, or we're on divert and they're going to a non-tribal facility. We know we can help improve patient outcomes if that system were better. So less slick and exciting than drones. But those are some of the exciting opportunities. And it can be as simple also as changing beds in facilities where maybe that's just a lower priority because they still work, or installing lifts for bariatric patients so that we have less injuries for our healthcare working team. So there's a lot of different opportunities that I get excited about when we talk about really what these opportunities look like, and things that I tell folks when they say, well, this might sound silly, but would this work? I'm like, I think it sounds great. You should apply for the state and let them tell you no.
Well, thank you. Just a brief follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up. Chair.
Thank you. And maybe just a secondary question to that. Well, I appreciate you bringing up Dr. Nelson and the work that he does, Go Pharmacy team. I think that there is a lot to offer in all of your answers. I wanted to think through sort of the role that some of the legislative pieces are going to come into this, particularly with what I would consider that mid-level practitioner field. And I think all of us are going to struggle through, you know, what does that look like for Alaska and where does that go? A number of our health committees have dealt with some of the compacts and licensure types issues. Do you have any comments on how, you know, you would foresee mid-level practitioners, specifically in Alaska healthcare? So I'm thinking physician's assistants, pharmacists, nurse practitioners, you know, the whole gamut of those people that kind of fill in the gaps that might be across the state. So, how do you think we should move forward as a legislative body with some of the needs that the Rural Healthcare Transformation Project asked for us to do?
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Ruffridge, you know, I think that's, I feel like that's a question best asked of the department. And I will say, just to be really direct, is there are some things the advisory council were asked about there to provide that direction versus decision making. Speaking as an advisory council member and as the body collectively, we did not take up some of the policy decisions that are directly in the lane for the legislature to move forward, perhaps in terms of bills for the governor to introduce. We did not weigh in, nor did we make recommendations on some of those policy provisions. Now, I will say each organization that serves on the advisory council may or may not support or may not have a position on some of the compact licensures. But I think in the role of the advisory council, those were not decisions or direction that the advisory council suggested the Department of Health implement.
Thank you.
All right, we have a running queue. I have Representative Gray and then Senator Klayman, Representative Mears, and then Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think I am kind of coming off of Senator Dunbar's line of questioning about how we're going to decide where the money should go, because I don't think it's very much money. Our state has enormous needs. And when I look at the initiatives, Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Communities, I look at who can receive this, and I see schools on the list, and I know what our deferred maintenance list is for our schools. I'm actually grateful that new construction is kept off the table. I believe that the expansion at ANTHC for the emergency room is $251 million is the cost, something like that.
Madam Chair, if I may, through the chair, Representative Gray, it's about $450 million.
Thank you. So so to expand, to add some beds and to create a new emergency bay is about $450 million. So you could see how if we threw out 20 of those projects, I mean, it's not going to cover. So, but when I think about the renovation fund, and I think about, you know, if I wanted to transform the health of rural school kids, maybe fixing the roof so they're not leaking, maybe making it so the toilets flush, and maybe getting rid of the mold would transform their health. And I think we could eat up this money very fast through that sort of interpretation of where the money should go. And that's just thinking about the Department of Education. OCS can use a lot of this money for technological advances. DOC can use a ton of this money to expand telehealth options in the prisons. I mean, I'm just thinking of all these ways where this money will disappear. And so, again, it's sort of like as the advisory committee, how do you guys make sure that we don't use all of the money for what I think are very important issues, but actually won't go in the direction of the transformation that you guys were looking for?
Through the chair, I mean, Representative, that's a really good point. We all have, I think what it really comes down to for this, and this is where I think the legislature is really critical, is what is the definition of transformation? Because yes. Some people, it might be really shiny, big, splashy things. I could tell you, for me and my constituency, it's the basics. In fact, and I've on record for years, if you really want to drive down healthcare costs, going and addressing social determinants of health, socioeconomic factors, that's really where you need to go, preventative health. When you start looking at it in that lens, you're right, it's not very much money. So I think that gets to that kind of central question of what is transformation? What does it mean in this project, in this program? And to be totally honest with you, if you do that right now, you're going to get really frustrated because you're going to run up into all those questions that we went over that are unresolved. And so I think that's where we're at, is I think we're all debating this and wondering, what should this be reserved for? We all have different opinions, and how do you settle on that? So I know I didn't answer your question directly, but I guess I'm trying to say is your question's very valid, and I wish I had a better answer for you.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, Nancy Merriman for the record. I think you make a great point and have good questions. I think some of those questions were contemplated as the notice of funding opportunity was designed. And certain limitations were put in place for categories of spend. So they're limited by percentage or by hard dollar amounts so that not everything could go into one thing. And it may be why they didn't include new construction, because to your point, the entire amount could be taken up with one building.
All right. We now have Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have three questions, but I'll try to get them quickly. First, Mental Health Trust is not here. Was that just scheduling in plane reservations, or have they been participating?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority was added a little bit later in the process, really with a focus on behavioral health, developmental disabilities, seniors living with dementia, Alzheimer's, right? They were a great addition to the team to cover some of those areas. I believe I don't want to steal the department's thunder, and I'm trying to be very conscientious and deferential to Commissioner Hedberg. There's another member that was added to really kind of round out the team. And I think they were added very recently, and a little bit this was already in the works for us to participate.
So there's not a fifth member, just they were the fourth member.
Madam Chair, through the chair, Senator Klayman, there is a fifth member. You know what?
through the chair, I'll just answer it really directly. Yeah, that's the whole point, is this has really, truly been evolving. I mean, we started at the very beginning ourselves talking to each other, and then that kind of coalesced in this advisory council. But yeah, to answer your question directly, Mental Health Trust, I know, was, I believe, has joined at this point, and I think the Alaska Municipal League was added. And no, they were not purposely excluded. I know we had just been working on this and were invited to be before the committee. So I think it's a coincidence, but I guess I'll be the one to steal thunder if thunder has been stolen. But yes, those are the five people that have started to participate in this advisory capacity.
All right, and then next question, which I think, Ms. Martin, you're the best one to answer this, because I believe you at ANTHC have been very involved in lots of outcomes and metrics and in terms of what ANTHC is doing. And I've heard now a couple of presentations in the Senate HESC committee and met with some folks. But the one thing I really haven't heard anything about is outcomes and metrics for this project. Have I just been missing it, or do we not have them yet? And if we don't have them, when can we expect to see some?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, at ANTHC, we have a very robust tribal epidemiology center. So I think we will start hearing about some of the Department of Health has included in some of their presentation high-level outcomes, which are 90% of seniors will have access to usual and accessible primary care. So they have some of those measures that we will broadly measure transformation in Alaska collectively. But I think we will see that in some of the applications that are submitted by organizations in Alaska and what we would propose doing as part of our application, and thereby what outcomes might we expect to achieve. Alaska Native people have, it's amazing how much I talk about colons in my job as a policy person, but Alaska Native people have a very high prevalence of colorectal cancer. So we're looking at opportunities. We have a fellow at the Alaska Native Medical Center who's studying up on things like what if we were to expand the use of ColoGuard to really address the backlog of Alaskans living in rural communities for cancer screenings. So we really anticipate applicants would really delve into with this investment. This is what we would propose we can achieve with those dollars. So I think we will start to see some really specific measures as part of applications that come to fruition.
So a comment on that, and then my last question. My comment on that is that it sounds like ANTHC has a lot more knowledge about outcomes and metrics than the department has, and I would be troubled if we're waiting for applications. It seems like you could help the department figure out some outcomes and metrics to help what the applications show rather than wait for the applications to show them, because it seems like that's one of the things we as the legislature might like to hear about. And my last question is actually for Mr. Cosin. I really appreciate the notion that the legislature needs to get more involved, but one of the more telling aspects of the questions we've had, including for the commissioner, at one of our hearings was, well, can't we be the ones that appropriate these? Can't we be in the ones that do these things? So, because we, the legislature, would like to be involved, and at least how I heard the answer was, no, you really can't be involved. This is a grant deal, and we're managing the grant, and you can really have nothing to do with it. And so I like the idea that the legislature can be involved. But what I heard from the department is, not really, you can't. And so you're here saying you need to be involved. And my question for you, and it may take a little longer than you can answer today, but if we can be involved, how can we be involved and be involved effectively? Because the last thing I want to be involved in is being involved in getting in the way of success. But I'm also very concerned that if we can be involved, it doesn't feel like there's much of a lane for us to do it right now.
Through the chair, Senator, before I answer your question, I do want to acknowledge the state has a great epidemiology team, too. Dr. McLaughlin and going back to COVID, so I don't want to overlook them. For the record, these are all individual opinions, right? That's a concept in an advisory body, so we all kind of freely speak for ourselves. And I say this in complete deference to the legislature. But if I were had the privilege of being in your position, it would be ludicrous for you guys not to be involved. It's too much money and too much at stake to not have involvement, especially with the power of the purse. But I also understand the concept of a federal grant and all of that. So to answer your question really directly, if I could set the rules on where I would want to see you involved and where I think the biggest impact could be achieved, it's not on the individual appropriations and funding decisions. To me, it is on the oversight and accountability. It's hearings. It is analyzing the decisions that are made and putting those on the public record and holding people accountable that make those decisions, so that if those kind of opaque moments happen or there's change up, people know why and people are held accountable. So I think that gets the legislature away from the potential of inadvertently delaying things that could then affect the funds actually being used, but puts you in a position of power that you really should be doing. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may add to that, I agree 100% with Jared's points on that. And I think there's unique opportunities where we sort of acknowledge things are really busy in Juneau for you. But there are other ways that the Department of Health has involved the legislature. If I may, I believe Senator Giesel served as an ex officio member to SB 74, the Medicaid reform bill from 2016, and made sure that the legislature had a seat at the table. And I think that is something we could certainly, I would be happy to take back to the department as looking at unique ways that we can ensure the legislature's involved in that conversation. And as a reminder, we are directional, not decision makers, but I think that is something I've certainly heard loud and clear last week when I was in Juneau and today in this forum, and I think it's something that we can certainly take to the Department of Health. I know you are all raising that concern, but I think we have a unique position and opportunity with the state to drive that home.
Thank you.
Only note when, if there's ex officio room on the ever-growing advisory committee, we could put the Hess chairs on the advisory committee and an ex officio member. They'd have to do it voluntarily, though.
Right. And next we have Representative Mears and then Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'll take the opportunity to say one of the things that we can do is tell you what's important to us. So I hear Ms. Martin about the fact that Medicare does and Medicaid doesn't take care of all the things that we have now. We're expecting those gaps to grow. Preventative health care, a lot of bang for the buck. And I would like to see the scale heavily weighed towards durable upstream changes. If the only thing we did with this money was reduce ACEs scores, that would be amazing. Certainly not the only thing that we can do, but that durable upstream is where I would like to see a lot of focus. Thank you.
All right, Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. Y'all's organizations bring a lot of valuable perspectives to the table. One thing they don't necessarily bring is the perspective of frontline workers. So what I've heard from nurses is concern about growing numbers of patients to nurses and very dangerous conditions in hospitals. Not all hospitals have a union, so we don't necessarily hear that from nurses at non-union hospitals. So I guess I would ask, what is your plan to solicit input from frontline workers in your organization so that we understand the challenges they see, and without asking them to review the 82-page application that Department of Health put in, just understanding the daily challenges they face might help all of us better understand where to direct RHTP money, because, you know, a rank and file nurse out in YKHC, I don't hear from them, or generally at ANMC even. So that I think that perspective would be valuable, and right now that voice just is not on the advisory council.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I guess being the one from, and you obviously have Alaska Native Medical Center with you, and I have the privilege of working with the hospitals. Absolutely. I mean, I understand concerns about conditions in different places and different circumstances, and you know, everything should be considered, and there's a lot of facts, I think, that need to be considered. So I don't want to jump in. I think that'd be unfair to say high-level things and just leave it there. But, yes, everything's a work in progress. But I would say that that's something I will take back to my membership, is the importance of engaging staff at all levels. Ms. Martin talked about this earlier, and we talked about this during COVID. If you were to ask me who's the most important person in the hospital, to me it's the people who clean the hospital rooms. Because if they are understaffed, or if they are unable to do their job, everything stops. And that's a custodial level job to some people. So I will take that back. I know employee forums, you know, large organizations, small organizations, everyone does it differently, but I think that's good feedback and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could add to that, through the chair, Representative Fields, I will say probably most every worker at ANTHC is not shy about sharing their ideas for improvement. And that's why we opened up the survey, to get feedback from workers. But additionally, our leadership team regularly rounds with frontline workers. Very recently, Natasha Singh, president and CEO at ANTHC, and Al Montoya, our COO, rounded with the EVS, the housekeeping team that take care of our patient housing locations. And that rounding wasn't standing around talking to workers. They put their rubber gloves on and cleaned rooms and talked to the workers about, you know, what are some of the things you hear? And right away, the workers said, man, we hear a lot from patients that these beds that the patients are staying in are horrible. And they went back to the office and ordered new beds for all of the patient lodging. So we purposefully, right, because not every frontline worker has a lot of time at a computer either. So really important to our COO, Mr. Montoya, is he rounds with at least one team every single day. day. And he makes sure that he provides some of those overnight hours so people working on Sunday at 11 p.m. have that opportunity to connect with leaders and share their opportunities for improvement. And we take those very seriously. It is not something you just don't often get that type of feedback from workers who are not sitting in front of a computer every day. So we make sure, very important to our leadership team, is that rounding to ensure that everybody who's busy with patient care, busy in the cafeteria, busy cleaning rooms, has that connection face-to-face leadership leadership face-to-face.
Madam Chair, if I may add, Nancy Merriman, for the record, recently I sat at a table at a community health center with some very impressive employees and staff who brought their own ideas about standing up a new line of business at this community health center. Very exciting. The super smart people, and to your point, Representative Fields, had they not asked, we wouldn't know. But that leader of that community health center happens to be one of those that regularly is in authentic conversations with their staff and really wants to capitalize on the intelligence and the aspiration of those people who really do have the hearts for their patients and their communities. So,
thank you. I have Representative Gray and then Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Ms. Merriman, I just wanted to highlight when you pointed out the federally qualified health clinics ideas of the geriatric clinic, the wound care clinic, and the school-based clinic. I love those ideas. I hope that they go forward, and I just wanted to draw attention to it as being really good ideas. I want to thank all three of you for being here, and I wanted to wish Monique Martin a happy birthday.
Madam Chair, if I may, through the chair, Representative Gray, thank you so much. It is my birthday today, and I am lucky enough to be in Juneau testifying on a beautiful day. So thank you so much.
A committee hearing is your birthday present. Senator Giesel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to comment, Nancy Merriman, when you were talking about the folks on the ground. It made me think of the community health workers at my Girdwood Clinic. And they certainly are providing vital services. It's part of the Rural Health Transformation Project to recognize those as clinicians for reimbursement, which will allow that program to flourish. The other thing I wanted to add, and perhaps Senator Klayman had forgotten this because I know that it had been announced, but the presiding officers of both bodies of the legislature, Speaker Edgman and Senator Stevens, did approach the commissioner about the importance of having legislators on the advisory council and suggested them as non-voting members. Both the presiding officers did appoint someone with advice from the co-chair or the two chairs of the body of the health committees. So Representative Mina will represent the House as a non-voting member, and I've been recommended to represent the Senate as a non-voting member. So there will be representation on the advisory council from the legislature.
We've grown from 3 to 4 to 5 to 6. Yes.
6, 7.
Very funny. Do we have any more comments from the committee or any other questions for our wonderful presenters today? Oh, Senator Myers, all on the way in the corner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, for Ms. Martin, I've been burning to ask this question for half an hour now. Those two gentlemen you spoke to, when you talked to them about how it would actually be useful to deliver medication by drones, what was their response?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I think our outside vendors have a lot of opportunity to really learn from rural Alaskans. And I said that to them. My feedback to them was, that's great that you came to Anchorage. Now get out and see rural Alaska. So I'm hopeful that they will take that advice. I also offered up that I think any of our organizations here presenting before you today would gladly help them find some community health centers, tribal health clinics, water and sanitation facilities, whatever it might be to see in rural Alaska. I also suggested they come back not in the summer months so they could get a real feel for Alaska. So hopefully, Senator Myers, they'll take us up on that offer.
Representative Prox, and we're close to our end time at 5 o'clock, so we have a few more minutes left. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you. This has been a fun exercise. And we talked about how do we think about what is transformative, and that's hard to put your mind around. And I was thinking many years ago, I worked in a bakery with my parents, and we got a machine that rolled hamburger buns. And that was transformative for the hamburger bun production, not necessarily the entire bakery, but there's little things that are transformative, and then there are bigger things that are transformative. We talked the drone delivery. It can be for medications. They're actually pretty close. They've got the drones. The university has got the drones figured out mechanically, operationally. It's just permission to get it done. But that could transform freight services where you could fly fresh vegetables and daily to a, I don't know, that might be transformative. There's all kinds of words. But it will be, don't be afraid, I guess, if it is disruptive. Sometimes things are transformative, things are disruptive. And don't be afraid to think about that. Think about them all. At this point, I would say, to me, it seems like just a big brainstorming session right now. And don't take anything off the table. It would be important to evaluate things objectively and figure out where we want to go. And I think we can get it done. The Department of Health, I thought, did a remarkable job gearing up to the COVID response. They can be done, and so good luck with it. Thank you.
With those closing remarks, I really want to thank our presenters and thank also the Senate Health and Social Services Committee for joining us here in Davis 106 and to really get a better understanding of what we can do with these rural health dollars that are coming to this state. And I would have the committee sing you a happy birthday, but we did not publicly notice that. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be next Tuesday, February 17th at 3:15 p.m. The time is 4:58 p.m., and this joint hearing of the House and Senate Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.